TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. Elaine Scarry is Professor of Aesthetics and General Theory of Value at Harvard. Her most recent book, Thermonuclear Monarchy, reminds us that one man, the President of the United States, has the power to end life for everyone else by setting off nuclear weapons. That's a possibility that remains very real even after the so-called end of the Cold War. Professor Scarry says that this deeply violates our constitutional rights, undermines the social contract, and is fundamentally at odds with the deliberative principles of democracy. And she offers a new line of arguments and strategy for the nuclear disarmament movement. Elaine Scarry illustrates her point most effectively by quoting Richard Nixon in 1974, when he was threatened with impeachment. Nixon told reporters, "I can go into my office and pick up the telephone, and in 25 minutes, 70 million people will be dead." End quote. At a time when the risk of nuclear war between the US and Russia around the conflict in Ukraine comes to worldwide attention, the status of the nuclear weapons arsenals and the question of who has the power to set them off becomes an existential question for all. Noam Chomsky said about the book Thermonuclear Monarchy, quote, "That we have escaped disaster so far is a near miracle." Elaine Scarry's remarkable contribution should inspire us to abolish this colossal folly. End quote. Elaine Scarry spoke in January 2015 at the Wellington Avenue Church, Chicago, by invitation of Chicago Area Peace Action. Here's Elaine Scarry.
My book, Thermonuclear Monarchy, is about the incompatibility between nuclear weapons and governance. I think if you ask people in the American public whether nuclear weapons are ungovernable, they would acknowledge that they're ungovernable in the sense that they're subject to accidents. Some of us right before today's meeting were talking about the accident of Minute Air Force Base, where for 36 hours, six nuclear bombs were left out in the public open on a plane without anyone realizing it. Some of you know the accident where a French submarine and a British submarine collided under the ocean, two nuclear submarines. So we acknowledge that nuclear weapons are ungovernable in that, like everything else in the world, they're subject to accidents, but with much greater consequences. People will also acknowledge that nuclear weapons are ungovernable in the sense that they're subject to hackers and to rogue states. And the most flagrant instance is perhaps the hacking of the Air Force plane, the F-35, which is a 90% digitized plane. In the year in which that happened, the federal government had suffered 18,000 acts of hacking. So this is not an isolated incident, although it's the only incident in which a plane designed for nuclear missiles had this experience. What the book Thermonuclear Monarchy argues is that there simply is no way to have a democracy and to have nuclear weapons. But rather than starting with my own book, I want to start by just a quick reminder of the physical consequences of nuclear weapons and the way in which nuclear weapons have eliminated from all people of the world the right of self-defense, because there is no way to defend yourself against them. The right of self-defense is the right underlying all other rights. It has also eliminated the right of mutual aid, our ability to assist one another in ways that I will elaborate. And when we eventually get to my book, you'll see that part of my emphasis is the fact that we do have the power to undo this. We just need to recognize it. One of the most extreme signs of the destructive capacity of nuclear weapons is the recent work done by physicists on nuclear winter, as recently as 2013, which shows that the early estimates from the 1980s, if anything, underestimated the effects of nuclear winter. That research shows that if only a tiny percent of the current world arsenal is used, not 1%, but 1/100th of 1%, 44 million people will die on the first day, and 1 billion people will die in the first month. The problem we have in understanding nuclear weapons is the problem of large numbers of people. People in public health point out that there's a difference between narrative compassion and statistical compassion. We're not always good at narrative compassion when we're asked to sympathize with one, two, or three people, but we're pretty good at it. We're not good at statistical compassion at all, so that if something involves the fate of tens of thousands of people, or as in the case of nuclear weapons, millions of people, we simply cannot get it at all. A colleague of mine who teaches at MIT told me that in a recent lecture to 200 students, a lecturer was using the names Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and realized that there were blank looks on the faces of these very intelligent, well-educated students, and stopped and said, "How many in this room know what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?" And only four people raised their hand. So there is an important reason to be aware of things of the past. But I'm going to, for a few minutes, be talking about targets of the future, because we can't undo the injuries that have happened in the past, whereas we absolutely can intervene and prevent the injuries that'll happen in the future. And I should say that, as I think you probably know, of the 17,000 existing weapons in the world today, 16,000 of them are weapons owned by the United States and Russia. The Natural Resources Defense Council points out that these weapons and their targets are not a kind of description of possible use. They're a directive for how the weapons are supposed to be used. And in fact, for each target, there is a specific particular weapon that is already assigned to that target. So it's much more concrete than we ordinarily think of it as being. Probably some of you felt what I felt when President Clinton, changed the targeting on our submarines to open ocean targeting. Up until that moment, the longitude and latitude of various cities were in all the missiles. He changed it to open ocean targeting because there was a danger that hackers would set off the missiles and launch them to those cities. But notice that that did not happen because Congress demanded it, the executive demanded it, or the military demanded it, or that we demanded it. It happened because hackers made people afraid to have the longitude and latitude already programmed in. If just 3% of the U.S. arsenal is used against a city, 50 million people will die. So 3% of our arsenal will result in the death of 50 million people. 50 million is about 17,000 times the number of people who were killed on 9/11, which can help us to understand the level of grief or mourning there would be. As I think probably some of you know, Scotland's recent vote, in which 46% of the population voted in favor of separating from England, was based on the wish to eliminate the Trident submarines from the Clyde River. The whole United Kingdom nuclear arsenal consists of four Trident submarines, and they are stationed in the Clyde River in Scotland. And the people in Scotland look on it as a morally obscene situation and want the weapons to be taken out. That was not widely reported, or it would be paragraph 15. Unless you were reading Joe's blog, or you were reading reports from Scotland, or in my case, I read Navy news releases, and the Navy, the U.S. Navy, certainly knew what the Scottish vote was about. And had they separated, that movement wanted to write a constitution that would make it illegal to have nuclear weapons in their country. By the way, the Scottish youth vote went for separation on the basis of wanting to get the tridents out. So today we say that young people aren't so aware of this, but a great feeling of hope comes from the fact that the youth in Scotland was very well aware of this. This is speaking about a country, the United Kingdom, that has 4 Trident submarines. The United States has 14 Ohio-class submarines, which is the equivalent of the UK Trident. Each of the 14 submarines has the equivalent of 4,000 Hiroshima blasts. That means that each of our 14 submarines has the ability to destroy a continent. The math of this can be hard to keep in mind, but here's a figure that's simple. The Earth has 7 continents. We have 14 Ohio-class submarines. People in the United States like to tell themselves that these nuclear weapons are a holdover from the Cold War. Nothing could be further from the truth. 8 of these 14 Ohio-class submarines were made after the opening of the Berlin Wall. So that means that 32,000 Hiroshima blasts were made after the opening of the Berlin Wall, and that's actually a higher level of blast power than the whole blast power of World War II, where 67 countries were involved in fighting one another. The United States, as you know, already has taken on the 12 new Ohio-class submarines. The first is slated to arrive in the year 2021, which is 6 years away, shortly after my niece Alana graduates. The last one will appear in 2035. And when I concentrate on the Ohio-class submarines, this is not because this is the worst part of our nuclear arsenal. In fact, our land-based nuclear weapons, the ICBMs, and the air delivery systems from the B-2s and the B-52s and the F-35s is actually higher blast power than our nuclear submarines. So the point of this first section of my talk is just to say that international law is designed to prevent this kind of injury. The Hague Convention, the Geneva Conventions, the St. Petersburg Declaration, conventions against genocide, all prohibit this kind of suffering. In 1995, 78 countries went to the International Court of Justice and asked the court to declare nuclear weapons illegal. The litigants included Islamic countries such as Qatar. It included countries that did not yet have nuclear weapons, like India and North Korea. And the various countries invoked the various international protocol, Hague, Geneva, and many other conventions, to beg the court to have these declared illegal. That, of course, included Japan saying it was the only country against which they've been used, and the Marshall Islands all talking about the illegality of weapons which indiscriminately go across borders. Here are two things to know about this law case. The United States, in a joint statement made by the Department of Defense and the Department of State, argued that having nuclear weapons, threatening to use nuclear weapons, using nuclear weapons, and using nuclear weapons first does not violate Geneva, does not violate Hague, does not violate the St. Petersburg Declaration, does not violate the conventions against genocide. They acknowledged that millions of people will be killed, but they said the intent wouldn't be to eliminate a specific race or ethnic group. Does not violate the conventions on the ozone layer and the environment. The second thing to know is that this case was not reported in the United States, though the case went on for months. You will look in vain in the LexisNexis to find any report of it. At most, it occasionally turned up on page 15 of the newspapers. So law is an attempt to address the problem of statistical compassion. It says, it doesn't matter whether you like me or not. You're not allowed to injure me. It doesn't matter whether I hold the same religious faith or not. You're not allowed to injure me. And yet, if these international laws are not being followed, then the international law seems to just subside. Now, you often hear our fellow citizens and residents in the United States saying, well, They're here to stay. They can't be unmade. And for a few moments, I just want to emphasize the fact that, of course, they can be unmade. Some of you may know the very powerful article written by Bill Joy in the year 2000 in the magazine, Wired magazine. Bill Joy wrote a very controversial article saying that one day it might happen that our robots are going to rebel against us. It sounds science fiction-y and crazy, until he points out that the prototype for this is nuclear weapons. Why? Because nuclear weapons can eliminate us, but we seem to feel that we can't eliminate them. And I want to just stress for a moment that there are many sources of evidence showing that they can be eliminated. Another report from Scotland by that same author, John Ainslie, called Disarming Trident, shows how long it would actually take UK to disarm their tridents. And he shows that it actually can be done very quickly. Some stages of it, dismantling the triggers, etc., take a matter of days or weeks, and other stages take months. But the overall timetable is something like 4 years. Admittedly, with a huge arsenal as the level we have, it would take much longer. But it certainly is doable. It's simply a matter of dismantling the weapons. Now, just think for a moment how much easier this is than global warming. I believe all of us should be working day and night to try and figure out how to stop global warming, but we don't quite know how to do it. With this, it's very straightforward how to do it. You dismantle all the weapons. The book that I've written, Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom, points out two provisions. It studies two provisions of the United States Constitution that are utterly incompatible with nuclear weapons. Now, you might say, given the fact that nuclear weapons cause this level of destruction, that they imperil the whole surface of the earth, what does it matter that it also involves the tearing up of the Constitution? But the point of this is to say, we have the tools through which we can demand that these missiles and these weapons be disarmed. This Constitution is our Constitution, and it enables us to restore governance. These are not accidental features. These two clauses in the Constitution that I'll tell you about in a moment are not accidental features of the Constitution. They are the heart of what a Constitution is, and I show this by going back to the philosophic origins of social contract theory and the work of Locke and Thomas Hobbes and the way in which they designed the social contract as, more than anything else, a tool for preventing injury and for overseeing a country's entry into war. If nuclear weapons and constitutions are utterly incompatible, which is what this book argues, if they are starkly incompatible, then if you're going to have your constitution, you cannot have nuclear weapons. If instead you have nuclear weapons, you cannot have your constitution. We've chosen the second. Now, something else happens. If you put away that constitution, you begin to think that it's just a feeble, useless piece of paper. And so part of what we need to do is to remember what a powerful tool this is, and what if we simply pick it up off the ground and begin to use it, it enables us to do. So the first provision that oversees war making is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, the requirement that we never go to war unless we have a congressional declaration. Some of you might say, don't even talk to me about Congress. Congress is so foolish and ridiculous that I don't even want to see what they have to do. But that's circular. Congress has become foolish because it has lost its oversight over the declaration of war. And the timing of this is not accidental. At the very moment when nuclear weapons were invented, or atomic weapons were invented, we stopped having congressional declarations of war. We have not had a congressional declaration of war since World War II, that is, since the invention of atomic weapons. We had a shadow of one in the Persian Gulf War, but it was a conditional declaration, and in all earlier declarations, that was seen as an illegal form of a declaration. The chapter on this in this book takes the five cases where we've had a congressional declaration. That's the War of 1812, the War of 1846, the Mexican-American War, the War of 1898, the Spanish-American War, and World War I and World War II, and looks at the quality of deliberation that goes on in going to war and contrasts it with presidential decisions about using atomic weapons. And over here you see very high-level deliberation, and over here you see no deliberation, and I'll elaborate that in a minute. But I realize I forgot to tell you something. Many people in the United States, most of us, think that if a president is thinking about using nuclear weapons, we'll know about it. Our model is the Cuban Missile Crisis. The president was thinking about using it, and we knew about it. That is not the model. We know now of at least 10 instances when presidents came very close to using nuclear weapons. Eisenhower administration, 1954, Taiwan Straits. Eisenhower administration, 1959, Berlin crisis. Three times during the Kennedy administration, Robert McNamara has told us that three times we came within a hairbreadth of all-out nuclear war. And he was the Secretary of State under Kennedy. President Johnson has said that he considered dropping them on China to prevent China from getting a nuclear weapon. Nixon has said he considered using them four times. What does he mean by considered? Well, in one of the instances, he actually sent 18 B-52 bombers loaded with nuclear weapons towards Vietnam over Russia. He meant it as a bluff, but bluffs that involve nuclear weapons are very perilous things to indulge in. All those instances are many decades ago because we only find out about them 30 or 40 years after they happen, when the presidential papers are released. The ones that are happening right now, we don't hear about. And I can give you examples of things that might make us wonder what our presidents are doing. So just a quick contrast between the congressional deliberation and the presidential deliberation. There are crucial features that they distinguish them. In the congressional deliberation, the members of Congress understand what they're voting on. There's a set of sentences. Be it hereby enacted that Congress assembled does hereby declare war. Everybody understands that's what the deliberation is about. In the Eisenhower papers, in the 1954 Taiwan Straits crisis and the 1959 Berlin crisis, there's no set of sentences on the table. There's just a mishmash of discussion that involves the word dropping an atomic bomb. In the Congress case, people have individual responsibility. After the deliberation, each person has to come up and say his or her name and give a vote, yes or no, and they will be on the record forever, as Janet Rankin is on the record forever as voting no against World War II, as are all the yes votes. There's no such vote in the presidential deliberation. Maybe most important, there's no dissent in the presidential deliberation. In the case of Congress, you have people dismantling one another's arguments, and that tests the arguments. Only if the arguments for going to war, only if the arguments that this country is the enemy can stand up against these counterarguments, will we actually go to war. And believe it or not, Congress makes very good arguments. It's in recent decades been infantilized so that everybody has given up on Congress, but that's in part because it's given up this power to oversee our entry into war. What do we find in the Eisenhower papers? Here's the closest thing to a moment of dissent or testing that I could find in the 1954 Taiwan Straits papers. Secretary of the Treasury Humphrey says, "Aren't we going to have a hard time explaining to the American people why islands with names they've never heard of, like Matsu, warranted dropping an atomic weapon?" Eisenhower says, "A mere look at the maps on the wall will persuade you of the strategic importance of these maps." Now, poor Secretary Humphrey, He had studied his notes from a meeting that had happened a couple of months earlier, in which Eisenhower had said, we might have a hard time explaining to the American people why islands they've never heard of were important enough for us to drop an atomic weapon. The important point to get, though, is that at the moment when Humphrey says that and Eisenhower reprimands him, no one else talks back. No one else says anything. End of story. And that follows from the nature of presidential councils. They are hierarchical. In that early moment, Eisenhower says, I might be impeached if I do this because first use of nuclear weapons, of atomic weapons, is in violation of the constitutional requirement for a declaration of war. By 1959, he has decided that if he just invites a few congressmen to his White House meetings, maybe that will kind of count as a congressional deliberation. So there are a number of senators and representatives there. And one of them, a man whose name will be familiar to you, Senator Fulbright, says in the midst of the conversation, wait a minute, I just want to make sure I understand what's being said here. Are we saying that East Germany might destroy the Autobahn routes in West Berlin and that we might have a repair company start to rebuild those, and that an East German soldier might fire a rifle at the repairman, and then we would drop an atomic bomb? Eisenhower says, well, we aren't exactly sure of the steps that would lead up to the dropping of the atomic bomb, but we know for sure that there won't be time to think it through once it starts happening. So Fulbright doesn't say, nor does anyone else say there, have you gone mad? Are we really going to massacre the East German people because somebody fires a rifle? But instead, the meeting goes quite calmly on. I believe that if Congress reacquires its responsibility for overseeing our entry into war, that it will regain the stature that it had in earlier periods.
That was the first part of a one-hour talk by Professor Elaine Scarry, author of Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. The acclaimed book was published by Norton in 2014. Elaine Scarry is professor of aesthetics and general theory of value at Harvard. Among her books are Thinking in an Emergency, On Beauty and Being Just, Dreaming by the Book, and The Body in Pain. She spoke on January 11, 2015, at the Wellington Avenue Church, Chicago, by invitation of Chicago Area Peace Action. Thanks so much to Dale Lehman for the recording. Come back when TUC Radio returns for another half hour on thermonuclear monarchy, focused on solutions, some of which may surprise you. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.